Hello and welcome to a somber edition of Big Mouth. The flags are at half-mast and I at least am wearing a black cape and cowl for the sad death of Stan Lee at the untimely young age of 95 years. Stan was the architect of Marvel Comics, a weird and unrepeatable mix of visionary, huckster, middlebrow poet and human billboard. His creations with artists Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko reached everybody from Mark Bolan and Paul McCartney to Al Murray and Frank Skinner. He created an entire universe, and it will continue long after he's gone. Later in the show, Dorian Linsky from our sister podcast Romaniacs will be joining us to talk about what Stan Lee achieved and what it all means. But first, I'm Andrew Harrison, and here with me, as usual, is Sean Pattenden, the capable wasp to my irredeemable Ant-Man. Hello, Sean, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
Have you had an exciting week?
It's been a medium to exciting week, which is good by me.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Who's our guest this time, Sean?
Our guest, well, funny you should mention it, she's a writer, musician and ex-TV person who worked for the Face Bazaar and Just 17. She researched Eurotrash and Rapido TV, and her books include I Know a Woman, Inspiring Stories of the Women Who Have Shaped Our World, and Rural London. She plays in not one, but two bands. Can it be possible? Ye Nuns and The Hare and Hoof. It's ye Kate Hodges. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
Welcome
Hello.
To Big Mouth.
Thank
Hello.
You. Thank you for having me.
What was your standout moment working for Bazaar, which was apparently the world's most disgusting magazine, as far as I remember it?
Yeah, the world's greatest magazine. Meeting the readers was a standout moment because they were all quite extraordinary in their own ways.
What occasion did you meet readers?
Well, we used to have events and we used to meet readers. Some of them had clothes on.
did they jangle as they walked up to you?
Yeah,
there was
Prince Albert, who we did feature in the magazine fairly heavily. You can probably guess where he came from. But yeah, he would bring his jangle bag, which was with him at all times.
Oh. Right. You also meet King Edward. It's also quite a bit of a larger implant there.
Yeah. Yes.
God.
Yeah, but I mean, my jaw is agape, as listeners cannot quite see. You didn't have any run-ins with people with no clothes in at all at these reader events?
No, I didn't. I kind of kept my distance from all that, but it was interesting.
It was the internet before the internet, wasn't
Yes, it was, actually, yeah. The internet kind of killed the magazine, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? What did you write about in it? Because it's got cult stuff, crime, fetishists. It's an alternative universe.
Yeah, I kind of covered... I was more the kind of culty, weirder culture, weird bands, folk horror type stuff. A little bit of real life crime,
Yeah.
A little bit of murder.
A place where the Wicker Man was seen as fairly mainstream, wasn't it?
The holiday destination, yeah.
But the readers were quite a sensitive bunch, were they?
Do you know what? They actually were. Yeah. They were. There was a lot of kind of... We attracted the outsiders. We attracted people. Our bunch were kind of, the weirdos in the corner who found a home.
That's good. Yeah. The magazine campaigned against the victimisation of goths.
That's right.
Which is a good thing, isn't it?
It is a good thing, yes. Wonderful. Very good thing.
Yeah, fantastic. Tell us about Ye Nuns and The Hare and the Hoof. Ye Nuns are an older prospect. Hare and Hoof is quite recent, am I right?
Yeah, Ye Nuns have been around for a fair few years now. I think it's probably about 14 years. We are an all-girl covers band. We cover the monks, Songs of the Monks, in our own inimitable style.
I Hate You is one of my favourite songs.
Oh, and we do a very loud version.
Oh,
of
wonderful.
I Hate You, very loud.
And
yeah.
Debbie Smith from Out of Echo Belly and many, many other forms is a nun too.
That's right. There's Debbie Smith from Out of Echo Belly. There's Debbie Bongo from Out of the Head Coatees. There's Delia and Andrea from Mambo Taxi. Charlie.
And, good. And how does The Hare and Hoof differ?
Oh, The Hare and Hoof is a very, very different proposition. Hare and Hoof is me and a bunch of childhood friends from Folkestone, and we started it as a garage band, but it appears that we're now a prog rock band, and we've just completed our first rock opera, which is about space, time-travelling scientists.
Fantastic.
Space and time-travelling scientists? My ears are pricking up here.
Absolutely.
So it's prog Folkestone?
Yeah, it is prog Folkestone, yeah. There's a lot of folk in it.
Prog Folkestone rock.
Amazing. What's it called, this concept album?
It's called The Terror of Melton.
The Terror of Melton.
Yeah.
That was John Pertwee, wasn't it? 1974.
Was it?
No, I'm just... sounds like it ought to be.
And will... I mean, it sounds like it's an audio event and you can listen to it. Will we ever see it as a prog rock opera?
Well, there are plans. We're kind of edging towards it. Yeah, okay. We have volunteers.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, who knows?
Wonderful stuff. Andrew, What's on this week's show?
I thought you'd never ask. On this week's Big Mouth, we've got the first tranche of the Kate Bush reissues. Remastered Part 1 features her first seven albums, from The Kick Inside to The Red Shoes. We will be revisiting Kate Bush the Leotard years and seeing how they stand up at 30 to 40 years remove. Plus, Outlaw King. Netflix tells the story of Robert the Bruce with buckets of gore and Chris Pine from Star Trek in the title role. Does it work, and do we have another Braveheart on our hands just in time for Scottish independence to happen? And everyone's banging on about the White Album, but
boo.
But did you know that Happy Mondays Bummed came out 30 years ago this month? We were going to be looking back at the golden age of Urchin Boogie and wondering where it all went. But first, a quick reminder from Sian.
You can get a little bit more Big Mouth in your inbox, which still sounds rude, every week if you back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. We record an exclusive extra bit for Patreon supporters each week. Help us to cover our studio costs by pledging the equivalent of the price of a pint. That's a fiver in Earth pounds. And we will send it to you every week just after Big Mouth comes out. And if you want to help spread the word about Big Mouth, why not leave a nice review and star rating on Apple Podcasts. It all helps get us noticed and out and about. Search Patreon Big Mouth or go to Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more about the extra bit. All we are saying is buy us a pint.
Right, as with David Bowie, Kate Bush's reputation has grown in stature the less she's done. She's put out a grand total of three new albums, plus that London residency thing, since 1993, and yet she's increasingly recognised as one of the truly giant artists. Now her back catalogue is re-released, not one by one, but in enormous take-it-or-leave-it chunks. Remastered One is out this week, and it features the hit single years Wuthering Heights, Cloudbusting, Hammer Horror, and this. Here's Running Up That Hill. Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews used to do a cartoon for Volume magazine called Running Up That Hill with Kate Bush, and it used to say, huff puff, nearly there. Next week, next week, that Kate does Ben Nevis. Kate Hodges, this is a daunting seven-disc box set. It's a full weekend there. Has you ever dived so deep into Kate Bush before?
Actually, yeah, I have, because I got into Kate Bush quite late. I got into her when she released Aerial.
Ah.
I mean, obviously I was aware of her when I was a kid, but I kind of... So I did. I kind of dove deep into her when that came out and went back and rediscovered her.
Had you gone back and done a bit of rediscovery when Aerial came out? Or was Aerial the world of Kate Bush to you?
That was it. That was kind of... Well, it wasn't really my entry point. I guess, you know, I was totally aware. I used to dance around the room pretending to be Kate Bush when I was little. And obviously being called Kate when it came out, you used to get a lot of...
It's great when you're Kate.
Yeah.
Happy Mondays, coming up later. So what did you make of this huge, you know, exploration of the of a kind of, it's like a 15-year chunk of her life, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, God, it's daunting listening to it. It's huge, there's a lot going on. I think that's what I made of it. I think what I didn't realise was quite how prog she was. And she was kind of, I know it's kind of often painted that she kind of came out of nowhere, but she didn't. She had this background in prog music.
Well, she seemed to appear fully formed. She didn't.
Yeah.
She wasn't this kind of naive figure who's kind of figuring out, you know, you can kind of imagine them trying to work out the fingering. She just arrives as this perfectly formed thing and really young as well. I mean, she's 19 when she's at number one with Wuthering Heights, but she'd been writing these songs since she was sort of 13, 14, I believe. So, you know, she does, you know, she arrives as a fully formed thing. Sean, were you a fan?
Well, no, I wasn't, and it's something that I think that you feel a bit bad about, isn't it? Are you a Kate Bush fan? No, not really. So you squirm a bit. You're meant to be one, aren't you?
Feel like
you?
A traitor to the women.
A little bit of a traitor to the women. However, I listened to this box set. Mm. I went and listened to it, and I thought, you know, okay, there's so much there.
How wrong I was.
I think I don't speak just for myself, and that the leotards had initially put me off. And there is a sort of, there's an enclave of a certain age of man who will drool as soon as you start just saying Kate. There's this idea that she is for those people. It's a bit pervy, but, you know, she plays the ingenue very much. But I didn't realise that she could play all the other characters. I felt terribly pretentious while reading this, listening to it, and was writing things like, she's Jane Eyre and the Mad Wife in the Attic at the same time.
Yes.
That's what I got out. I just thought, this is incredible. Sat in Your Lap is the most amazing piece of music that I've heard for weeks. And, you know, it was released years ago, and I thought, actually, I feel like a bit of a dunce, as she is in the video, in that I didn't get it, and I think I get it a bit more now.
And it's a brilliant song about creativity, but also not being asked. I just can't be asked to do it. And this person who is, you know, her work is so massive. It's so worked, isn't it? It's so massively put together.
Yeah.
She began producing herself after a second album and never let anybody else, you know, imprint herself on it. And even she is, like, sometimes when I lie on my bed, sitting in the house and do absolutely nothing whatsoever, is brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that one thing that left out to me was the more you listen, the more you realise that she was so strange and so different and so out of left field that the response, mostly from blokes, was kind of humour and mockery. It's like, oh, it was a particularly nasty Not the 9 o'clock news video that took the piss out of her and had Pamela Stevenson hopping around in a leotard, oh, it's just because I'm sexy. And you look at the work now and you think you didn't get it. You so didn't get it.
Yeah, they completely didn't understand. I think that really did come across to me as well, is that she was really kind of in control of her, literally in control of her own voice. Like she could go from track to track. The first track would be whispering and sibilant and the next track should be screaming almost, and she really she knew what to do with her voice, and that's amazing at 19 to have that control over yourself, and also artistically she knew what she was doing too. It was just,
well, I've done enormously deep journalistic research on this. According to Wikipedia, this comes from her training in kung fu, where she was known as an ee, because this was her cry as performing her martial arts. And you can actually hear this in the singing, the kind of the different modulations and the kind of use of her voice almost as a percussive instrument, as well as being a character person.
Yeah. There's a wonderful phrase I read when reading up a bit more about it, as well as avant AOR, which I think is an amazing way to describe it. Someone else had put, especially about Peter Gabriel and other people of that time, it was a bizarre mix of angular musical anarchy with pre-punk musoness.
Yeah,
mixed in. So you have something that is really difficult to define, because she is not sitting on the street. She's not the Clash, is she? There's no element of she's, you know, speaking for, you know, the underdog. She is weird, but she uses it. And it is, as you say, the production on that, when you really actually get deep down and listen all weekend to Kate Bush, it's a conversation. It's a world. It's a something else. You can absolutely lose yourself in it. And I'm deep in admiration now. I feel, as I say, a little bit of a fool for just thinking it was the lady in the leotard that has a very high range.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about, you know, she's now kind of acclaimed as a strong woman artist, as a kind of a, you know, as a an inspiration and so forth. But when she appeared, it was like, well, Dave Gilmour has discovered this girl, and she's this project of Dave Gilmour's. Mm. And she was kind of underrated and considered to be this sort of this novelty who had sort of sprung from Dave's world of prog.
Yeah, very much so, I think. And I think she really overturned that when she took charge of her production. So for the third album, she was doing it herself. She was putting in donkey noises.
Yes, she was
putting in footsteps. And it's just sounded incredible.
Mind you, there are whale noises on track two of the Kick Inside debut album. Let's go album by album quickly. Kick Inside, debut from 1978. That really announces the voice and the look, doesn't it? She was famously very, very young. And the kind of piano and the languid pace feels completely foreign to today's try-hard pop, doesn't it? It feels complete. And yes, it produces hits.
Absolutely. And everybody does say how weird she is and how she kind of landed from outer space. And I do agree to a certain extent. But at the time, the charts were really weird. I can remember when you would have the Bee Gees in the charts, and they were blooming weird. They looked crazy. And next to the Sweet, next to Blondie. You know, it was a weird time, I think, for the charts. 1978, you had the tail end of disco and you had punk was just kind of hitting its stride. And then you had other things, pop kicking off early.
But also you'd have, as Sean just mentioned, you'd have a lot of AOR and even country. You'd have very, very, you know, when Radio 2 was literally for people in their late 60s, people who were born before the First World War listened to Radio 2. And you had this strange thing that a piece of avant-garde art, which is what Wuthering Heights is or what Breathing is, could equally be liked by your nan. Oh, I like that one. It's, you know, isn't she so expressive?
Yeah, I mean, because you have to remember where she appeared. I mean, I don't think I saw her on Top of the Pops. I think I probably wasn't allowed to watch it at that point, but I must have seen her on Cracker Jack or Jim Will Fix It or something like that. You know, she was everywhere at that point. She really did. It just infiltrated popular culture. It was extraordinary to do that so young.
The themes on that first album are quite rare in pop as well. She does pregnancy, even though she hasn't had a child yet. And she was brought, you know, a lot of concern with the life of an unborn child. She was brought up Catholic. The Man with the Child in His Eyes. And then, I think track two is saxophone, which is basically saxophone as phallic symbol. weird as hell, and it's immensely literary. She puts out Lionheart the very same year, the second album. It's not as good, but it has got Wow on it, which is pretty incredible. And, you know, everything from Mystical Englishness to Kashka from Baghdad, which is about a gay couple who can't talk about their relationship. This is something she's putting out when she's like 19 or 20.
And she could have gone anywhere with that. It's one of those albums where you think she could go pop after that, but then completely have gone underground and more folky, all that sort of thing. Again, it's her now finding that control thing with that album. Although it wasn't one of my favourites, you can see then the roots and the genesis for everything else coming after it.
Yeah. And then it's Never Forever, which is the first album by a British female artist to go to number one in the UK album chart, which sounds absurd. That must have happened before, but it hadn't. And it's the most varied one. She does Babushka, which is a fantastic short story, but produced in this insane Russian pop glam style. And, you know, drum machine pop and all this, you know, it's probably the most varied one she's done so far, isn't it? And even when she goes insane on The Dreaming.
Which is my favourite, I think.
Oh, is it? It would be your favourite. Yeah. Why is it your favourite?
Because it feels unstructured and it feels loose and it feels like, you know, she's come from being Jane Eyre and a bit bolshy to being the mad woman in the attic. And she's going, okay, I'm going to be the mad woman in the attic and I'm going to just show you. But that's where she's really using the Fairlight and the other. She's getting into technology and the studio-ness. She's a studio boffin.
She's just
putting her voice out there and thinking, God, I have to be the face of this, but actually starting to play with it and more comfortable with it. And you know, the themes in it, they're all about betrayal and love, the Houdini stuff and the cover. And she's... I love the cover in that she is looking, she's so coiffed, so she looks like one of those 80s models, but she's got this key in her mouth and she's not giving it to Houdini. She's looking, oh, I could use this myself. Oh, it's amazing. You could gaze that forever. But she's just not playing by the rules. I think maybe that's the thing I like about it. She really isn't. But the more you get into it, the more you hear the hooks and the melodic nature that doesn't seem to be there at first.
Kate, you mentioned the voice and the you know, going from very soft to screaming. There's a track, on The Dreaming, Get Out of My House, apparently inspired by The Shining. She's basically being, you know, both the pursuer and the pursued in the Overlook Hotel. And the voice is terrifying.
Scary. Yeah. I mean, that's what I love. And she inhabits her characters so absolutely. You know, she, and I think, on that one particularly, she is terrifying.
She samples her own answer phone as well.
Does she?
Because it had hit a meltdown. It was obviously a tape one would be at that time. And it started making weird noises and it's all over the end of it. Yeah.
I love that. She was such a boffin, such a studio boffin, and unashamedly. And I love that picture of her. There's a picture of her buying a Fairlight. And she was in so early with all of that stuff. She was really, really, really leading the way for that, not just for women, but for everyone. She was kind of setting down these extraordinary moments.
I mean, the box also contains Hounds of Love, which is all the big hits in Running Up That Hill, and which is basically Love Comes Quickly with different words. And, you know, Hounds of Love. The Sensual World is on there too. It's kind of her slow jams, knocking boots, sexy one. And The Red Shoes is kind of her last bow before she sort of disappears, vanishes into a cloud of art and becomes Björk. I mean... It is an unusual idea that people should introduce themselves or reintroduce themselves to an artist with a 7-CD box set. But you kind of could with this, couldn't you?
I rather like it, and I like the fact that there are no outtakes, as far as I know. There's no meandering 6-minute version of something that nearly happened and then got morphed into that. So we don't see the wheels and the cogs and what was on sensibly a cutting room floor. We see the work.
Yeah.
And that's quite good because there's so much rehash of things and trying to, you know, put demos out and stuff and live things. Yeah, that's fine. But actually, I like it. This is my work. It's my complete work. There's 7 albums. Go and listen to them
apparently for the rest
of the year.
The only revisions is on the next box set, which he's taken Rolf Harris's voice off.
Yes, I did read that.
And replaced it with the voice of her son. I support her in that decision. I think that's only the reason.
I think it's a wise decision. And she's not made a comment about it publicly. And it's
well, she
quite
doesn't make, like
nice
David Bowie, thing. She doesn't make comments about anything at all anymore, which makes her more interesting. There you go.
David Bowie can't.
No, well, he didn't. Even when he could, he didn't. So we're in approval. Remastered.
But
one.
I really like it. And I'm berating myself. I'm hitting myself with a stick for having felt that maybe she was a lot more lightweight than she actually is. Right, that's enough art. Let's have some grimy old rock and roll. We always ask our guests to choose a tune for the show, and this week it's Kate Hodges. What have you brought in for us?
I brought in John Spencer, Do the Trash Can. John Spencer, you, formerly of John Spencer's Blues Explosion.
Where did the Blues Explosion go?
They exploded.
They did actually explode. And he's back with a solo album, his first solo album. And I saw him the other day, and he was incredible. He's absolutely brilliant. He's still so full of energy and fire and interact with the audience, and he was just brilliant. This album is great. It's such fun.
What does he shout now that he can't shout Blues Explosion every 2 minutes? Does he shout John Spencer every 2 minutes?
Well, when I saw him shouting Ye Nuns.
Oh, that's nice of him.
So, yeah, we supported them the other day.
Oh, bless him.
So, yeah, bless him. Thank you, John. But, he is just... this album is so much fun, and so... it's a party album for old people. Love it.
Oh, well, it's found the right spot then. Shall we have a listen?
Yes, it has.
This is John Spencer, sans Blues Explosion with Trash Can. The great Stan Lee has ascended to the astral plane, and if, like me, you grew up on Mighty World of Marvel and Spider-Man Comics Weekly, it is as if a light has gone out from the cosmos, all the cosmoses. Dorian Linsky, regular on Big Mouth and from our sister podcast Romaniacs, is here, and he's a fellow true believer. Dorian, what did Stan achieve in comics that nobody else had achieved? What did Stan do for Marvel?
Whew. Well, I mean, there's a few things there. I think obviously one was just co-creating a slew of still the most sort of, you know, famous characters in comics in a very short period of time.
Often to order, we need something for here.
Yeah.
Let's quickly create the Black Panther. Later, 40 years, 50 years later, to become the most successful Marvel movie of the lot.
Which I saw in one obit. Black Panther was named because of the movie, the success of the movie. Black Panther was named before Spider-Man, Thor, Iron Man, and the Hulk. You know, which just shows that actually it changes over time, which the most important are.
Yeah.
So he created all these, you know, all these characters with artists like Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, but he also brought to it, I remember just as a kid, loving his voice, loving the fact that he was a bit of a cornball. Like, he was very sincere and also corny, and he would do the whole, you know, the Make Mine Marvel and the vibe in the bullpen, and the idea that this was like a gang of people that you were going to hang out with.
Yeah, with Jolting Joe Sinnott and Jolly Jack Kirby. Everyone had a nickname.
Yeah.
It was very much kind of you're in the army with Stan in the 50s or something, aren't you?
But I think, when you read about actually how these comics were created, it was this sort of this unbelievable pace. It reminds me of kind of stories of Motown, you know, where they really did just sort of have to bash them out. It's pretty much, give me a hit.
Yeah.
And he was just throwing stuff at people. He goes, right, we've got the Hulk and we're worried that someone else is going to do a female Hulk if we don't do it. So now we've got to do She-Hulk. Somebody write that. Or we're going to change the X-Men. Somebody create a bunch of new X-Men. And it was just this kind of, this amazing, enduring characters that came out of, you know, real pressure cooker situations and just like, maybe we should have a blind superhero. You know, and Daredevil evolved into something so much richer than that. But it just started, a lot of the time it did start from quite cynical, we need a black superhero. We need a blind superhero.
Yeah.
So it was this way in which he was kind of like, he was not like the best, you know, not one of the best writers. It wasn't like he had the best sort of artistry. A lot of his skill was this hustle, which obviously extended to the fact that he had a cameo in every Marvel movie, extended deep into his 90s. You know, just this kind of, again, I think with this Motown or Tin Pan Alley thing, this bit where art meets commerce, in a brilliant kind of American showman.
Well, there was a lot of art in it. I mean, people, you know, comics people have often sort of thought as Stan as a bit of a carnival barker, huckster, kind of salesman, roll up type of guy. But when you look at the kind of golden period of the 60s, it's as much informed by Jack Kerouac and William Blake as it is by, you know, let's get them through the door and get some bums on seats. You know, the Fantastic Four cosmic stuff, the Galactus stuff, and Doctor Strange. This is genuinely informed by wide reading and by philosophy and by interest in religion. I mean, essentially, everything I know about Judaism, I know through Marvel comics, from the Golem and the whole Megillah and all that kind of thing. He was a well-read guy, and he was interested in stuff, you know. And there was a huge sort of power there in his ridiculous grandiloquence.
Oh, yeah.
Every character, you gibbering jack and apes, all this kind of stuff.
Well, when I started studying... you know, Shakespeare and, you know, great writers at school, I was constantly coming across stuff like, you know, The Iceman Cometh by Eugene O'Neill. And I was like, oh, it's not literally about Iceman from the X-Men, you know. And it was always, behold the Dominator or whatever.
Yeah.
And,
be this a man or be this monster, all that kind of carry on. Yeah. And
particularly in Thor, obviously. Then, boy, did he go for it with Thor.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like, well, Thor was cornball Shakespeare, wasn't it?
Yeah.
what we've heard a lot of in recent days, because, I mean, I was rather proud to see Stan makes it onto the BBC News. You know, this stuff matters now. Mm. And this nonsense from when I was a kid is now important. Well, we saw a lot of the discussion about how, he wrote soap operas. He wrote character stories that were more about relationships. And I think that's almost a pat way of looking at it, because what he did was he made the secret identity as important as the costumed identity, and then more important, because Peter Parker, Spider-Man's really the story of Peter Parker. You know, the idea that, you know, the with great power comes great responsibility idea of what happens if you, snotty little teenager, if your power fantasy came true, what would be the price of that? And how would you handle it? How would you deal with it? What would it exact from you as you grew up? It wasn't just, hey, I can whack the bully now.
Well, there's often this idea from people who aren't that au fait with comics that it was sort of only in the 80s with the sort of the dark stuff and the Dark Knight and Watchmen. There was like, but what would be the real consequences of having superpowers? Mm. And of course, he was working. He wasn't going dark. Super dark was not his thing.
Yeah.
But he was exploring the consequences of that really early on, which is why these characters have so much room. You can do a lot with Iron Man, the kind of the rich asshole who invents this super suit.
Yeah.
He's an interesting character. He's a completely different character to Spider-Man, who's a completely different character to Hulk, who is constantly tormented and guilty. It's like these incredibly rich characters that he sort of banged out, that, and most of them hold up. There are some where, you know, you can see sometimes in the movies and the later comics that people have had to do a lot of work fleshing them out.
Mm.
But most of them were kind of there, and they did come from a lot of the thing that sort of come up is that letter that he wrote in 1968 about the sort of political content of
Stan's
Marvel
soapbox.
Comics. Stan's soapbox.
Stan's soapbox on bigotry, which has been flying around social media.
Exactly, and I think that was really important because people now, there seems to be this weird short memory syndrome where it's just like sort of wokeness and diversity. You know, they've only existed, political consciousness has only existed like in the last 5 years on the internet.
Mm.
And of course, at the time, it was all about these kind of, it was the nerds and it was the outcasts and, you know, that sort of spirit, this sort of like underdog outsider spirit, that changes. That's updated.
Yeah. And particularly, mentioned Black Panther, when we encounter Black Panther in the Fantastic Four for the first time, this idea of a technologically powerful kingdom hidden in Africa is a production of two, like, white, lower class, you know, working class Jewish guys in New York. It's not a product of a sort of black political analysis, African-American consciousness or anything. It's them putting themselves into it. It's them imagining this thing. And it's proved to have this incredible life afterwards in a way that a generation of people who only know Marvel through the movies as connected with. I mean, people like you and me, we basically, because Marvel was reprinted in Britain, the 60s were reprinted in the 70s, we basically experienced the 60s during the 70s, didn't we? So you're kind of seeing the, you know, working, even with things like, I remember a Hulk episode where they were talking about radical chic and, you know, the kind of the new journalism. And I'm reading this in a weekly comic in 1976. It just gave you this kind of crash course in a particular side of American culture.
Well, I think one of the great things, of course, was that it allowed all these writers, many of the writers who were these kind of like oddballs, writers and artists, who were oddballs and mavericks, and they could kind of slip their own things in there. And it was sort of, you've got sort of Stan as the major writer and creator in the early days. And then you have sort of Stan as the kind of, you know, the godhead of the Marvel Universe. But then all these incredible people were allowed in. We were allowed to do loads of stuff. It doesn't seem like he wasn't like it's this sort of Barry, return to the Motown analogy. He wasn't like a sort of Berry Gordy going, well, you can't do that. That's too weird. I mean, every now and then there might be something that was just too out there. But already it's like it's thrown it open so wide in terms of having political content, in terms of having cosmic insanity.
Yeah.
That actually there was, it created lots and lots of room for people to do stuff. And there aren't many. You know, there's just something about those characters, you know, where they're expected to be sort of reinvented all the time and people can do other things with them. And it's the sense that obviously he could lay claim to co-creating them, but everybody else got to get to work on them. And you can't, that wouldn't work unless in the first place there was all this potential, if they were, you know, if they weren't multidimensional.
Yeah, and all done quickly to order. To fill some space.
And what really touched me was that my daughter was saying, why didn't you tell me Stan Lee had died? She's 12. And she was really upset that I hadn't told her, because it was a really big deal that this 95-year-old man had died. And when I was 12, I don't think there were any 95-year-old men whose deaths would have touched me. It's quite incredible that he seems to kids like a modern figure and not somebody who was born in the 1920s.
Enough said.
Now, the movies, or at least movies that appear on telly first, mainly. Netflix are increasingly making the running as the outlet for movies that don't fit studio marketing plans or are just a bit weird. The latest release is Outlaw King, retelling and to some extent reshaping the Robert the Bruce story with Chris Star Trek Pine as the hero of Scottish independence and a host of recognisable character actors as Edward I, the Second, and other English rotters. Here's a taster.
Thinking about revenge.
Where's Robert? Where's your husband?
It tears at the soul.
Where's your brother?
No!
But it can also be a weapon.
I'm done with running and I'm sick of hiding.
Power is making decisions. And whatever course you are charting, I choose you. My husband.
We need to unite Scotland.
Robert the Bruce is an outlaw. Any man or woman who would give shelter to him or his ranks is to be executed without trial.
The people are desperate for justice.
I serve Robert Bruce! Join us to free our
land! I have 50 men to fight the strongest army in the world. This is how we do it. Take the land back castle by castle.
We could fight for God. For country. For family. I do not care. So long as you fight!
Scotland in 1304, Edward I is supposed to nominate a new king, but instead he seizes Scotland, and we open with the English lording it over the humiliated Scots, especially the Prince of Wales, horrible Edward II to be, who really rubs Robert the Bruce's face in it. Kate, did you enjoy this blood-sodden pain to how awful the English are and how great the Scots are?
I did, I loved it. I mean, I can't say I love it. I enjoyed it. I love a bit of pomp. I love a bit of mud and blood, and I enjoyed it. It was some. I think you're right. It's very much a post-Brexit.
Not the Brexit. Yes.
Yeah. And I think the Scots are going to enjoy it immensely. And
have you got any Scottish in you? No,
I haven't.
I've got a homeopathic 12.5% or something, which was very much reacting to this film.
I bet it was. But it was waving its flag. I thought it was good fun. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of. It started quite slowly. Hmm. There's a lot of are you with me? Are you not with me? I really enjoyed the cameo by William Wallace's cameo. His leg just hung up.
Brave leg, yes.
Brave leg. It reminded me of a bit of a Christmas little ham or something. You know, just hanging there as a warning. But I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the special effects and the noise, and the battle scenes were very, very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it squarely puts you in the place of the defeated Scots and makes you kind of feel the humiliation. But to me, it's like we are now able to tell grand events from British history with the scale, sweep and artificial hundreds of thousands of battling warriors and fake London skyline that Game of Thrones has shown us how to do. It's basically the Game of Thrones tablet applied to real life, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Except this stuff mostly really happened. Sean, did you enjoy it? What did you think?
I'm glad Kate enjoyed it. I put it on and I felt that it was cheesy. I felt it was... the good guys are good and the bad guys are bad. And yeah, I like the gory stuff. So the gory, someone gets hung, drawn and quartered. That was quite good. And they can do that. It was all in focus.
High praise indeed.
Actually, there's a Netflix thing of everything being in focus at the moment. It's slightly driving me mad because it's for 4K telly. So I just want to see something that's a bit kind of weirder than that. But there were points I just thought, I can't get into this. And I have quite a lot of Scottish blood. It wasn't reacting very well to it. I thought that, I don't know, they all look like hipsters and Robert Bruce is too good. He's just all good. I mean, I was sort of switched off by the point he was doing bad stuff. He was good. The new wife was good. Good against evil.
Because he marries Chris de Burgh's daughter, doesn't he?
Robert
de Burgh is the...
I didn't know what it was telling me new, and I didn't think there were undercurrents or enough of a subtext. I wanted a bit more something more of a wrestle against humanity there.
Well, the kind of moral hinge, the moral turning point.
The moral hinge would have been good.
Where he basically murders his rival. For the Scottish crown, which in the film it's presented as very much a kind of, well, you know, he kind of had no choice. Poor old Robert the Bruce pushed into a corner by Conway or whatever. And actually, in real life, apparently it was much more calculated than that. And Robert the Bruce is a lot more of a rotter than Chris Pine is projecting here. But it's a movie, you know, and I'm sure that Edward I wasn't quite as dreadful. I mean, I know Edward II is always viewed as a weak and rather useless king, but also has been serially kind of slandered through the ages as a dreadful homosexual with his friendship with Piers Gaveston. A slander on him, and he's presented here as Joffrey from Game of Thrones, as kind of mad. Vicious sociopathic prince. I don't know how much truth there is in that. It all seems to be lined up to give you something quite movie-ish.
It really does, and I do agree. I think the characters were very black and white in a way that Game of Thrones characters weren't. There's a lot more kind of nuance and politics in Game of Thrones and Machiavelli and stuff. This is kind of less so, but I think maybe it has to be because it is 2 hours rather than...
Game of Thrones is very good at introducing you to a total bastard and then making you feel over six seasons that you actually understand and even like and admire them. Mm. And vice versa, showing you a hero and showing you the emptiness of heroism and how heroism is fundamentally a narcissistic thing. So, but maybe you can do that over a period of 80 hours of television.
Yeah. This was condensed into 2 hours.
We do have to talk about the Netflixification of everything, them versus Amazon, and also because this was available and still is available in some cinemas. So what Netflix are trying to do is put something on at the Curzon, a rival to Amazon, so that they get some Oscar nods and people do start taking them seriously as a platform for films rather than where you dump the stuff that you can't get made. And that's the problem I have with it, is I think they squeaky cleaned it. There's probably a script which isn't so good versus evil. There's probably a script that was a little bit more interesting or maybe longer. I feel there's a bit of a Disneyfication of the story in order to get it out into cinemas and to start this way. Netflix going to own us one day, like Google do in a way.
Maybe.
I mean, am I being so super cynical?
I don't. I mean, if imagine there was no Netflix element involved in this and you'd just seen it at the pictures, would you think that's a pretty exciting and emotive and serviceable piece of, historical revisionism? I don't know. I mean, I think I really liked the construction of the world, the fact that this is not kind of medieval balls and shining knights on armor. Everything's filthy. Everything's covered in mud. Every battle, which does actually, some of the battles extend into the ludicrous, don't they? We see the Douglas, the head of the Clan Douglas, drenched in blood, waving a sword around, just screaming, "Douglas! Douglas!" at the top of his voice. And it does get a little bit ridiculous. And without giving too much away about the finale, there is a bit of a ultimate clash of hero and villain, which is played out in a very movie-ish manner. But I enjoyed just the kind of the grain of the world, the grittiness of the world. I also particularly enjoyed Edward I, who I thought was a great crime boss, as monarchs go.
I thought they borrowed a lot from Fitzcarraldo and Werner Herzog in general in his historical films, where it does look grimy and mucky, and those beautiful scenes of a whole army marching, a really big long shot, which they have in Fitzcarraldo quite a lot. And I think the reference points are really nice. The idea of this, a huge amount of people who are just going to get slaughtered in 1 second's time, that's not really giving anything away. There were those elements that I thought were really courageous, but then I just think that we get to plot where it just went a bit eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
Yeah,
The
occasional element of black humour. So we do keep seeing bits of William Wallace lying around. Is that his head? Oh, it's his head. You know, here's a leg. I don't think that's a spoiler. We all know, don't we? 700 years later, we all know he was hung, drawn and quartered. It made me think that, yes, you absolutely, we've now arrived, just as we've arrived in a world where you can make a superhero movie that looks real because the effects are there, we've arrived in a place where you can actually properly stage great historical moments in a manner that is entirely believable. And you can place the camera in the middle of a battle, because I thought that the kind of climactic battle here very much echoed the climactic battle in the last series of Game of Thrones, where you finally see the Battle of the Bastards, where you finally see the battle, and the camera puts you right in on Jon Snow's shoulder, and you are seeing limbs flying, heads exploding, blood all over the place, and giving you a sense of the absolute horror of what it would be to, like, to be in that place.
Absolutely. I do think it puts you right at the centre of the action. And it kind of, I mean, even kind of looking back at Lord of the Rings and films like that, they seem a long time ago now. The technology has improved so much. I read that they worked on the blood splatters and the blood spray, particularly for Outlaw King, which was interesting. And they were all sprayed in blood. It wasn't just kind of... It wasn't just pulsating out. Yeah. It was just.
Nobody ever says it's just
stuff.
A flesh wound, Sarge. It's just like arms are flying through the air.
But maybe the film is just that. That's the climactic scene. That's all it's going to. All we are being prepared for is that scene.
Maybe.
I think it's interesting that we expect that TV programs have set us up to expect more now of our films, and this is a film. It's not a TV program.
Films look a bit thin these days. Yeah. And what films
you
are like?
Say,
oh no, I think it's true. Not all of them. Obviously, there are many films which take full advantage of which understand that television is making the running now, and they have to do something different. They have to extend themselves more, not in terms of length, but in terms of the understanding of their characters. But I do think that the major problem that movies have these days is they're too movie-ish. You know, the three-act structure. Everybody has to be sketched out very quickly and efficiently. And if you've watched more than half a dozen films in your life, you can plan ahead quite easily. This made me think I would very much like a 10-part Netflix War of the Roses, where the complexities can be explored. I would very much like a 10-part, 20-part, Scottish Independence series from HBO.
Absolutely. I think that's what it needs. It is a sketch. It's a sketch rather than an oil painting, isn't it? I think a TV programme would have.
Well, anyway, it's a decent Wednesday night stream with a glass of single malt if you like that sort of thing. If you enjoy Big Mouth, we think you'll enjoy another of our music podcasts. Be There with Dali Loudspeakers, manufacturers of the very best in high-end sound reproduction with the very finest in Danish design. Be There with Dali looks at the stories behind great music, and it ties in with Dali's own music magazine, which is also called Be There. You can get a copy of the magazine for free from the Dali Loudspeakers Facebook page, and the podcast is available now on your favourite app, with a good few familiar Big Mouth voices to be heard. On the latest edition, we got some of our regulars to listen to their favourite album anew on Dali Loudspeakers, and Kate Mossman of The New Statesman chose The Miracle by Queen.
Queen produce all their own records, so they are control freaks, and from very, very early on in their career they got rid of their producer, and you can hear them develop, and the critically acclaimed albums are the ones in the 70s now. They are, they're sort of densely layered, extremely ambitious, the classic Bohemian Rhapsody harmonies and all this kind of thing, and then the fat guitar sound, and in the 80s they became quite, they followed fashions and they became very good at synths and space and
electronic
sort of kinds of music. And the reason I chose The Miracle was that it's unlike either of those two phases in their career, and it's a full stop because it's the penultimate album they did, and they recorded it live pretty much in Goldhawk Road and in Switzerland. And there's something about it which is it's extremely big in its sound, but it's loose and it's full of space and it's full almost like a sense of human error. They were so good by this point that they were a sealed unit and they didn't let anyone else in on their process, and they argued about every single beat and every single note that was on the record. And it's with any really well-produced record, you should be able to just think, I don't know what they did there.
Kate Mossman on the latest edition of the Be There with Dali podcast. Subscribe now on your favourite podcast app. Just search Be There with Dali.
Finally, 50 years since the Beatles' White Album, that there are other things in pop. Did you realise, for instance, that it's 30 years since the Happy Mondays put out their second album, Bummed, November 1988, crikey, when Acid House was already turning music inside out and widening trousers, and the White Album was only as old as Madonna's Ray of Light is now. That's terrifying.
Isn't it?
Time, I can't deal with it. Right, nobody is ever going to re-release Bummed with 8 extra discs of slightly different takes. Happy Mondays could only just about do one take before Sean Ryder popped out for a KFC. But it stands as one of the most bizarre and entertaining records of our time, and we're going to talk about it after this track, Mad Cyril. We've been together. or rendering that scaffolding dangerous. I'm not sure if I said it right, but I love that line. Kate Hodges, you've listened to Bummed. What are your memories of Happy Mondays from 1988?
Well, my memories are that I remember getting this on cassette and sitting up in my brother's bedroom, listening to it over and over and over again and just being incredibly excited. But it was a big, big album for me. I wasn't really into Acid House. I was too young to be into Acid House. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a car, couldn't get to raves. Lived a long way out of town. Acid House, I didn't get it because I didn't go out and I didn't dance to it. So it just sounded really impersonal and cold to me. But this made dance music human to me. I don't even know if it's dance music. It's just...
You can dance to it.
You can dance
therefore,
to it.
Therefore, it's dance music.
Yeah, I loved it. And I just think it was so exciting to hear a band making this music rather than just one person making this music. What a band. There were some kind of cartoon character dads who were shambling around off their faces, and it was just so exciting. They're so bad dads. So cartoony, so and it sounds incredible now, listening back to it. It still sounds incredible. It still sounds different to everything else that's going on at that time. It sounds Technicolor. It's you know, I was 15, so I wasn't so long off nursery rhymes anyway. And he sings he literally sings nursery rhymes.
Yeah. I have a theory about Sean, which is he was so off his head for decades that he would sing a Beatles song and think he'd made it up. He would sing a nursery rhyme and think he'd made it up. And Sean is not daft. Sean is an incredibly clever person. He's a naturally talented, clever individual who happened to be born and brought up in an area that was not advantageous to that, and then fell into lifestyles that were not advantageous to that either. So he's a mad autodidact. And you can tell, I mean, there are references to the film Performance twice on this album. Yeah. There's samples and there's a track called Performance. Yeah. So they're not, there was a caricature in the music press. They're just a bunch of idiot proles who, you know, were just, you know, robbing cars and taking drugs. They weren't like that. They had a functioning, working and a very, very strange intellect going on in there, didn't they?
Yeah. What did you feel when you listened to this? How many have you not listened to it, do you think, from the early 90s?
Actually, to be honest with you, I listen to this fairly regularly because I listen to all music on shuffle at all times. So everything pops up. So my entire record collection is on permanent shuffle and Bummed is always popping up, and it's always, you know, Do It Better or Bring a Friend or Lazy Eyes is always popping up, and it sort of stops me tracks a little bit. But to listen to it in isolation from beginning to end did freshen it up a little bit to me and remind me of how very, very strange this record was. So it's produced by Martin Hannett, Martin Joy Division factory record go-to guy with his unique, unrepeatable ears. And you kind of get this impression that it's recorded in a kind of smoke-filled meat locker, you know, where everybody's crowning in and falling on top of each other. And the Happy Mondays are simultaneously kind of, it's sort of like it's naive creativity crossed with total ineptitude from certain members of the band. And yet other members of the band are incredibly talented, like Mark Cow Day, the guitarist, because they all had the name Cow. And famously, Knobhead. Knobhead's the keyboard player. Knobhead, you should be in here.
Yeah.
You know, Cow has this really odd, oblique kind of way of just coming into a song totally in an unexpected fashion. And there's also, as with a record like this, the tracks all kind of meld into one.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if it's on Do It Better or Mad Cyril, but that guitar just goes dur, 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 in a way that doesn't fit anything at all, but stands out totally as that is the sound of Happy Mondays.
One of my theories about why those tracks, there are two theories, why the tracks melt into one is, I think this album is amazing. I remember I got it on vinyl when it came out. I played it all the time. And I haven't listened to it for decades. And I just thought, God, I played this all the time. I know all the words. But one of the things is the production on it. They have this drum sound, which is a room sound, but it's like a really mega room sound. There's loads of delay on it, so it sounds really far away. And what Martin Hannett has done, he's done something similar but not exactly the same with the guitars. So they sound really, not distorted, but far away, so you can't almost reach it. Vocals aren't mixed that high, so it's something about, these are people that you can't quite get to. This is a feeling that you've got to really try and get. There's something so distant about it. It's so clever and shambolic at the same time as being structured that I think no one could have sounded like that. No one does. There's no album that sounds like this at all. And another theory is that most of their songs are the same song anyway.
Yeah.
Country song is tart, tart, but slower. There's not very much difference to it structurally. And there are a few that really are, you know, the song is changing, you know, only in one chord or something. So it does sort of sound the same and different than you say you've got the nursery rhymes and you've got, you know, the Beatles lyric and things coming in. It sounds like a very odd dream. And I still think Sean William Ryder is absolute genius at lyrics.
Yeah.
I mean, there is nobody like him who could write that stuff about. It's his life, isn't it? It's horrible and filthy and disgusting.
But also
really
funny
honest.
And clever.
Yeah. He's clever.
And you know, singing your picture, now I'm going to eat your... No, it's disgusting.
Yeah, it is disgusting.
Yeah.
Apparently, Martin Hannett did try and set fire to the studio at points. He was drinking a bottle of brandy a day when they recorded this. It wasn't, you know, it's not a quick session where everyone's in 9 to 5.
But also, this is their Ecstasy album, isn't it? This is their kind of like their... And I'm listening to this thinking, that does not sound like Ecstasy to me. That sounds like a band in a room that is on fire, you know, falling over each other. And then, of course, Pill Thrills and Bellyaches comes out. And it's really, you know, full of sunshine and happiness. And I think that's an Ecstasy album. No, that's a heroin and crack album, actually. So, you know, it shows how little I know. But what really struck me about this was that, again, you know, because they arrived in the era where the music press still mattered. And they were kind of a bit... The music press did not know what to make of Happy Mondays, because after years and years of, you know, fetishizing fey middle class, you know, boys with their feelings, suddenly a bunch of actual urchin, you know, semi criminal thugs rolls up, and they are both entranced and terrified, and they don't know what to do with them. And the Happy Mondays fill up the NME for about 18 months with their capering, because they're amazing copy. They look like the Bash Street Kids on remand. They are, you know, they're just absolutely perfect.
I was so excited whenever they were on the cover of the NME or the Melody Maker. I would go out of my way to buy a copy, because you knew you were just going to read the entry and laugh and laugh and laugh all the way through. They were just absolutely brilliant. But I do think that because of that, then perhaps they're a bit underrated, because they're kind of Sean Ryder and Bears are seen as kind of figures of fun. Then maybe that their music is a bit underrated. And to go back and listen to it again kind of reminds you that, God, they're amazing.
Well, I think the music is catastrophically underrated, and in large measure it's their own fault, because they have, because of the unique set of relationships in the band, they have ballsed up numerous comebacks.
Unlike
the Stone Roses, who to me are a tenth, a fifth, you know, 1% of the band the Happy Mondays
are. Incredibly corporate compared to
Mondays, you know,
aren't they?
But Stone Roses kind of get to play the gigantic reunion gigs, they get the huge deals. And yet, Happy Mondays were the most creative group to come out of that whole scene of that particular time. There's been comebacks that haven't quite worked, and then they sort of put the records out on remasters and it didn't quite work.
But if you remember, if you saw the Happy Mondays live at the time, they were shit.
They were all over the place.
They were crap live. And that kind of made it more exciting, because you knew that it meant that they were shambolic and it could implode at any point. And I like going to see them because of that. But they're not very, you know, they could do it now because you could have some sequencing in the background or something like that.
But that would sort of be wrong, wouldn't it?
But it would be wrong.
I saw them at the bit on the Yes, the catastrophic Yes Please tour at Manchester. I think it was a Free Trade Hall or something. And Sean performed the show sitting at the back with his head in his hands, just crouched over the mic, clearly in real dire self-inflicted straits. And yet, I never saw them on a Bun tour, but people said it was the most amazing thing they'd ever seen in their lives. I would immediately go out, burn all their tight trousers, get a bowl-head haircut, get flares on, and start and turn into Billy Anfield, like, you know, like when Kevin and Perry discover Oasis, you know, and start drawing beards on. It was a transformative moment.
I think one thing about remix culture, which I would say we don't have it so much now, but I'm sure people in dance music would tell me I was wrong, is that the remix culture could make the structure. You could play the Happy Mondays remix, couldn't you, at a disco, rather than have the band on?
Disco. or a youth club, for instance.
Yes. So, yes, if you're feeling frisky. the remix is doing the job of getting out to the audience and the playing live, because they're so all over the place.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, yeah, and also this is kind of... at the end of Bummed comes the Vince Clarke mix of Wrote for Luck, which sort of opens them
and
up to be...
Paul Oakenfold.
Paul Oakenfold, and then he would go on to...
Yeah, and then you're able, then suddenly they're in clubs. But I was always amused at the idea that, like, because I, you know, my suspicion was that there were hundreds of thousands of weed smoking layabouts up and down the country looking for their music, and they partly found it in Acid House, where you could just go out and bingle and bongle around and be an idiot because that's tremendous fun and it's not trying to tell you the meaning of life. But then they find their band who are like them, who are simultaneously those kind of layabout urchin, you know, but also are dead clever and dead funny. And a gang, and a naughty, a naughty gang. But I'm always amused at the idea that of people who discovered Happy Mondays around Pills and Thrills going, oh, I think I'll have a look at their back catalogue. And they go and buy Bummed. And they take out the inner sleeve with the shaven, naked woman on the inside. It's one of the most disturbing photographs ever put out in the name of pop music.
There are a few, though.
There are a few. Yeah. And then maybe they go and discover 24-hour party people, and they're genuinely shocked by that as well.
Maybe, maybe. I love the fact it was recorded at a studio called Slaughterhouse in Driffield.
It sounds like it.
Amazing. Can I just read a couple of lyrics?
Go on.
You know I like doing it. It's amazing ones on here, but one of the ones I just love... Grass-eyed, slant-eyed, brain-dead fucker. Rips off himself, steals from his brother. And it's just a song about this. Or someone who's even more awful than someone in the Happy Mondays.
Or is he thinking about himself?
I don't know.
Well, Sean can be quite critical.
Yeah,
I wonder what's going on with...
He's a poet.
He is a poet. What's going on in You've Been With Fat Lady Wrestlers and Germans in Trenches and Teachers Who Speak to Themselves? What does that mean? Where does that come from? Is this again Sean's subconscious bubbling to the surface?
Good, 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 good,
double, double, good. Yeah, yeah. We need a book of Sean's lyrics.
We do. I mean, it reminded me of the Neil Tennant book Faber. It's like Faber, do it.
Come on, yeah, Faber, get a grip. This is never going to be treated with the reverence of rock classic, is it?
Well, maybe.
I don't want it to. I don't want it to be canonised.
Oh, I suppose.
And I don't think it can be because, like, Sean Ryder actually admits that he can't remember anything about recording any of his records, so he's never going to go to Mojo, he's never going to go to Uncut and talk about how we recorded this because he can't remember. And I kind of like that.
Hannett's
it's just
dead.
Gone. Yeah.
You know, the rest of them aren't talking to each other. I think Cow, the last time I ran into Cow, he had quite a good internet marketing business. I think he was doing call centre things.
Yeah.
He was almost a sensible one. He was never off his shed, as they would say. The rest of them.
Yeah, and Bez has a career as Bez. He travels around the country.
He invented Bez.
He
did. Pretty good.
It's a full-time job. Anyway, we've got time for one more tune, and it's Sean's turn. What have you chosen, Sean?
Oh, for some reason, there's no logic to this whatsoever, but I've been listening to it quite a lot. It's the Colourbox official World Cup theme from 1986.
Okay.
I think because it's in a time bubble of when... life seemed less complicated and there wasn't this sort of the global stuff we get from rolling news and things like that and always worrying about bloody Brexit. I listened to this and it's so optimistic. It's all synth, it's all sequenced. It's not even any lyrics. It was Build It and They Will Come. It's like we'll do a World Cup theme and maybe someone will use it for the World Cup theme. They weren't asked to do it. They're a 4AD band. When 4AD was still slightly ethereal, they'd also signed these tech wizards. And it is just so jolly and wonderful. And I'm walking down the street and I often almost get run over listening to this song because it's so fabulous. So cheers for that. It's the one song that is definitely going to cheer me up.
Okay, well, here we go. Colourbox official World Cup theme. And that is the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be talking about over a Death in the Afternoon cocktail while Sean and Bez knock out a few Mrs. Mills in the gay traitor Hacienda cocktail bar of their minds? Kate Hodges, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I've been thinking a lot this week about the Lancaster Music Co-op.
Haven't we all?
Yes, it's been on my mind. It's a place up in Lancaster. It's Lovely Eggs, David, works there. Mm-hmm. And it's threatened with closure at the moment because they're going to be... the city council is trying to evict them, and they are...
They're not being kicked out for a coffee shop or an artisan bakery.
Well, this is it. I think that they brought up the... Well, Lancaster City Council was in partnership with some developers. They were meant to develop it. It never happened. And now they never had a long enough lease to make changes to the building that they needed to. And so now the city council is saying it's derelict, so you're going to have to move out. And they want to make the changes. They want to stay there. And it's really nice watching all these bands come together to kind of it's a bit like a feel good film.
I was going to say it's like a Cliff Richard movie.
It's very much.
They're
like
going to knock the youth club down.
Yeah,
let's have a gig to raise money and buy
exactly
it.
Exactly, a heartwarming tale. Yeah. And it's only heartwarming if there's a happy ending.
So what are they actually doing? Can the listeners help out and participate?
If they go to the Lancaster Co-op's Facebook page, they can kind of go there and join in, sign petitions, and I think there's some demonstrations and some meetings as well that they can go and join in with.
Amazing. Okay, good stuff. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I've got a moral tale for our times. No surprise there then. There is a band called Threaten And it is mainly someone called Jared Threaten's work. He's a Californian singer-songwriter. And he organised himself a tour, pretending, we believe, to be his own manager. And organised a tour in the UK, came over here and told everyone it sold out. So told all the venues it sold out. How that happened, I'm not sure, because shortly he was obviously acting as his own promoter and all the rest you need with the tour. No one came.
Did he actually perform the gigs, or did he?
Yes. But he performed the gigs. He got support acts in. And he got some quite good gothy support acts. You can look it up if you want to. And you know, they came to see the sellout show, and there's no one in the audience. Sometimes there was one person who would buy the ticket out of pity. They'd play to no one, and they'd just try and ask him about it, and he wouldn't say anything. And someone said, "Oh, he seemed quite happy playing to no one. He actually didn't really seem bothered." But the support acts were really, really miffed. What I find interesting...
I love the idea of a miffed goth metal band.
1950s never left me.
Corpse-filled monster were really miffed, but nobody turned up.
It's true. But what I really like about this story is some of the promoters then tried to get in touch with Jared Threaten and said, look, actually, you've got loads of publicity about this. You could come back next year. Because everyone's talking about it, you know, the band with no fans. And what he's done is he's blocked all of those promoters on Twitter. He's put all of his social media onto lockdown, so their personal accounts. When this is his moment. This is the fame that he wanted.
It's a genius
he's now
move.
Skewed it.
I think it's a genius. I think it's because it will only build the demand. All good managers know. You show them it and then you take it away so they really want it. And also, let's be honest, first and only incidents of a band that really is making music for itself, and if somebody else likes it, it's a bonus. Nobody else likes it, and he doesn't.
Yeah, no one else actually did that. They said it. They did. And what's lovely is he's got a promo picture. I'll just show it to the assembled group.
It's him inside a yellow...
Gold frame.
There we go.
It's probably cost 5p to 10p. Yes, I'm saying to take that picture and put it on the internet. There's threatening for you.
There will be demand. People
threatening
will want
nothing.
There'll be like 5,000 people saw the pistols at the Vortex and didn't really. There'll be people up down the country going, "Yeah, I saw threatening. Amazing. Yeah great. Yeah, I saw them
really
before
good.
You'd heard of them."
Yeah, the support power a bit miffed though.
Yeah, a bit miffed. Yeah. Miffed was supporting them. Anyway, my closing time chatter. I was in the pub the other day at after a music business event, and I overheard somebody say, "He used to manage Britney Spears," and his mate said, "No, he used to manage Burning Spear." A bit of a difference, which made me appeal for great musical mishearings from my various friends. Friend of the show, Mike Shulcross, was banging on about the very, very cool dubstep label Skull Disco to his friends. Skull Disco, the great. And after 10 minutes of this, his mate realised he was talking about Cheese Fest School Disco, you know, where they dress up as a dinner lady and play, you know, "I Should Be So Lucky at You." So we had to rewind that one very quickly. And the unnamed reporter for Select magazine, who went off to interview Cast and got the scoop that they were about to put out an album called Midget Allah, a little tiny Muslim deity, Midget Allah. And they then went and did a bit of fact check with the press office and discovered that the album's going to be called Magic Hour. But because of John Power's Scouse accents, Midget Hour, Magic Hour. So this is, I very nearly went into the magazine. So nice. Listeners, if you have similar terrible music mishearings, please do stick on the Facebook page. So that's our show. Thank you, Kate Hodges, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Kate's going to stick around for the extra bit. We're connected to the passing of the late, great Stan Lee. We're going to be asking, do we ever get over the things we loved when we were 12 years old? Or is it only me? You can get that if you back us on Patreon. Just search Patreon Romaniacs on your favourite podcast app. Thank you to Kate and Sean. Thanks to producer Elsie Bath making her debut on the show. Thank you, Elsie. And thank you for listening. And we're going to see you all next week. Bye.
Bye.